Hello and welcome to Kayncast, a podcast that provides commentary on the economy and financial markets by the Kayne Anderson Rudnick Investment Management Team.
Hello, this is Ben Falcone, Managing Director with Kayne Anderson Rudnick, and with me today I have Julie Beal, KAR's Chief Market Strategist. Welcome back, Julie. Julie, the first quarter and heading into the second quarter has been quite volatile across domestic markets, especially. Exuberance for deregulation, pro-market policies, and Fed rate cuts have turned to growth fears and inflation persistence with the implementation of a protectionist strategy and tariffs. Can you speak about your views on the future impact of these policies and how this could impact the different equity categories from small to large in the U.S.?
It's been a very tumultuous start to begin the year. Over the past 6 weeks, we've seen tariff malaise erase close to $6 trillion in U.S. stock value. Many are worried how the incoming administration's position on widespread use of tariffs would fare, but I don't think anyone could have guessed the magnitude of the impact on equity markets. And for now, the Trump administration appears ready to stomach the economic impact of the tariffs in hopes of spurring domestic production and consumption by turning away from international trade. Now, for us, it is unclear how an electorate that blamed President Biden for persistently higher prices will respond to a near-term increase in costs across a broad swath of goods, which is expected as a result of these tariffs. Now, when we think about the tariffs, we really see three channels of impact. The first impact is likely to be on domestic consumption. Now, we would characterize a tariff as a tax on consumption. All else being equal, that means tariffs should reduce consumer demand, which creates a headwind for our economy, which is two-thirds driven by consumer spending. Second, and an offset to reduced consumer spending would be a lower trade deficit. And while positive, the scale of this is small compared to the likely impact on demand. The third and perhaps most troubling impact of tariffs is the headwind of uncertainty. This affects both consumers and perhaps, I think, more profoundly, business investment. While the Trump administration was forthright in its intentions to impose tariffs, the scale has been much larger than expected, and the implementation has been uneven in its execution. It's created a lot of uncertainty, and what has happened is that businesses don't actually have a lot of incentive to be out there investing in CapEx or hiring people. We have great confidence in most companies' ability to adapt to changing market conditions. We saw that in the pandemic. We saw that with supply chain changes. And we saw that with tariffs last time too. But without clarity and at least some degree of policy stability, the best course of action is going to be inaction for most companies. And that all by itself can do long-term damage. We're seeing very early signs of this in survey data for both consumers and business leaders. And many feel that the lack of clarity makes it really difficult to allocate capital and create any kind of long-term strategies. Now, investors have reacted to all of these questions with broad-based selling, moving away from the things that worked so well recently. So that includes a sell-off in the Mag 7 stocks, but also renewed interest in international markets. European equities in particular have been popular. And we haven't seen this large of a divergence in performance between the S&P 500 and European stocks since the 1980s. Now, in terms of how tariffs have actually impacted our approach to investing at KAR, the answer might surprise you. It's not very much. Given the level of uncertainty and the degree of market malaise, it would actually be foolish to try to perfectly position a portfolio for a specific outcome. There are simply too many diverging and conflicting possibilities to try to predict that any of them will occur with any reasonable accuracy. For example, we could make an argument that because small caps are less dependent on exports to foreign markets, they could outperform. But small caps can be more economically sensitive, and if a trade war leads to a U.S. recession, they may be challenged. In our view, the better strategy is, of course, diversification, but with a focus on quality. This is really not the time for needless speculation and trying to position and anticipate what's going to happen. I think even those within Trump's own administration have not been able to predict the direction of policy. So how are we supposed to do that? We continue to be confident that investing in quality companies that have demonstrated an ability to nurture and protect their competitive advantage in adapting to a wide range of market outcomes really is what serves our clients best. After being challenged to match index performance last year due to the strong rotation into AI stocks, the majority of our strategies are demonstrating the typical downside protection we are known for. And we will gladly take this as an opportunity to expand or establish new positions in companies that were too expensive. But for the most part, we continue to stay the course and focus on individual fundamentals.
Julie, while the U.S. consumer continues to spend and unemployment is low, expectations for future spending and inflation expectations both look pretty grim. What is your view on the strength of the U.S. consumer for the rest of the year?
If we look at recent survey data, it appears that the U.S. consumer is feeling far more negative than just a few months ago. The widely tracked University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index is at its lowest point since the global financial crisis, with the exception of the outbreak of COVID-19 in August 2011, when the S&P fell 6.7% in a single day. The European sovereign debt crisis was raging, and the S&P downgraded its credit rating for the U.S. Hardly good comps. Now, business confidence has also declined. The Institute for Supply Management's Purchasing Managers Index, that's a mouthful, for the manufacturing sector in March shows new orders and backlogs contracting, along with production and employment. Supplier deliveries slowed from last month. Raw material inventories grew, as did customers' inventories, while prices increased. Exports contract and imports grew, perhaps in anticipation of tariffs to be imposed in April. Now, normally we would caution against reading too much into soft survey data, as we often have seen periods of low consumer confidence that actually conflicts with strong consumer spending. But it is a clue into the consumer mindset, and that's important because remember, 2/3 of the U.S. economy is driven by the consumer. Many of us all feel exhausted by higher prices, most notably grocery prices, which have not seen any material relief in terms of inflation. The prospect of paying even higher prices to pursue an abstract goal of American exceptionalism may feel less compelling than it did last November. Comments from President Trump and Treasury Secretary Bessent that near-term pain should be expected is perhaps not the salve that consumers need right now. Now, that said, very few have ever struck it rich betting against the U.S. consumer. They have been the backbone of a decade-plus economic expansion that we have all enjoyed. With unemployment still healthy, we do think consumer spending should remain intact, although with perhaps more deterioration for those at lower income levels. These are people who are going to be more pressured by higher prices on normal grocery store goods, commodities. They are really feeling the pressure already, and they could be even more so. We think every consumer in every income bracket is fatigued by the evaporation of value they have experienced while shopping over the last few years. So we think this favors any consumer brand or company that focuses on offering good deals or value. If I think about broadly the consumer, for now, I think we're okay. But I think if there are changes in the job market, that will really change, and that can change very quickly. It's important to remember that when we are in periods of recession, yes, there are people who lose their jobs, but what really crushes demand is people scared of losing their jobs. Everyone starts to pull back on their spending for their discretionary items because they're afraid of that fear. And that is actually what makes recessions better or worse.
Julie, what are your thoughts on government spending cuts and their impact on the market from a growth and inflation perspective?
If I think about the government spending cuts, for me, they have a more psychological impact and they have a more profound impact on geopolitical issues that right now we are facing than they are necessarily right here, right now. Part of that is so much of the goodwill that we have been able to establish as a country has been on the back of programs like USAID, where we choose to step in and benevolently support struggling economies, support countries that are under pressure from other dictatorships, etc. And we've benefited from a lot of good, healthy goodwill. I worry that for the long term, we could see a negative impact from pulling back on this. I would liken it to spending all of your air miles all at once on a trip you didn't even really need to take. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me why we would be trying to upset the apple cart of global trade that has really benefited most in a really meaningful way for decades. Now, if I think about the consumer spending cuts at home in terms of education, our healthcare system, most of these are going to be at the margin for now, as of what's been announced. But I do have concerns that it leads to more economic insecurity. So it may not have a direct impact, but if it creates more insecurity in people's psyches in terms of, are these education grants going to be funded? Are we going to see continued spending in terms of research processes? That does have a chilling effect on demand globally. And that is more the concern that I have than the immediate impact of pulling back on some of that domestic spending.
Julie, can you speak about the merits of quality investing today versus exposure to more commodity types of businesses?
I think right now, at least these first few months of 2025, has been a real reflection of the benefits of being a quality-minded investor. We've really seen quite a lot of relative outperformance in across our strategies, be they growth, value, core, small, mid, large cap. What we're really seeing is that in times of stress, we tend to gravitate towards the companies that other portfolio managers are loath to sell. They know they're good quality businesses. They know they have durable earnings. They know that this is the type of company that can weather the storm. And when your whole portfolio is mostly made up of those, you're going to tend to outperform in more difficult periods like we have right now. The high level of uncertainty means that most professional investors are looking for certainty of earnings, clarity of earnings. So I think more important than trying to position for a specific outcome on tariffs, what we've really demonstrated, you know, time and time again at Cain over our 40-year history is the ability to own these quality companies allows us to better weather these downturns. And that makes it much easier for us to outperform over the long term, which is, again, very much what we care about. When you're talking about more commodity type businesses, these are the types of businesses that are going to be probably the most impacted by, you know, negative impacts from tariffs. They typically are companies that don't have pricing power, or they may have a weak competitive position. They may struggle to find their customers, you know, when we see demand softening because of higher prices. So those are the types of businesses that are probably the most economically sensitive and vulnerable. Some of them have been pushed up by speculation that they would be the types of companies that would get bought under a lower regulatory regime that was softer. But now that's really called into question, because if their earnings are deteriorating materially, they're not going to be as compelling as a buyout candidate.
Julie, we continue to see structural strength in AI growth, albeit with mixed performance this quarter from the Mag 7 and pure play AI companies. Can you update us with any examples of how it is being utilized broadly across KAR strategies, with an example or two of where it has the potential to make a profitable difference going forward?
So I think we continue to be really intrigued by the potential of artificial intelligence, though we have some skepticism near term. We continue to believe that fundamentally AI is going to change the nature of work, how we communicate, how we learn. But here at Cain, we are decidedly not futurists. It's really easy to see how disruptive technology can be to many domains and how profoundly it could change the research, analytics, healthcare, insurance. There's really not a place we don't think it could impact. But we're still in the really early stages of this technology. And what concerns us is how technology companies will monetize these huge billions and billions of dollars of investments they're making in AI. I think it's really important to remember that not all disruptive technologies lead to outside riches for the inventors or for the early adopters. Aviation is a great example. We have all benefited from aviation. The benefits of being able to travel are incredible. But the industry as a whole really didn't start making money until the 90s. And even then, it's been pretty difficult for them. E-commerce is another great example. So many retailers flock to e-commerce as a way to be able to compete against Amazon, as a way to be able to grow their customer share, as a way to be able to get their existing customers to spend more money. And what's interesting is that they actually did see their customers spending more money if they were an omni-channel, that is, they shopped online and in store. But what they really hadn't factored in was that all they were doing was making it easier to order two or three sizes, keep what you like, and send it back, adding the whole cost of returns. And returns on inventory, on your efficiency for a retailer, are killers. They're really hard on your profitability. They're really hard on your margins. So I think that while many viewed e-commerce as this opportunity to grow their business and expand their profitability, what they actually saw was that their margins were permanently impaired because they now have this extra cost structure to run their e-commerce. They've made it easier for consumers to return goods. And they also have these high expectations of free shipping, free returns, no problem, that Amazon really kind of had a lot of leadership on. It's really difficult for them to recoup and recover from that. So I think it's really important to think not all the early adopters or vendors are going to fare as well, right? I bring up the e-commerce example, not because I actually think that's how AI will play out, but we want to be careful of just assuming that the disruptors go the spoils. It's still too early to know who the real leaders are going to be. Just last quarter, I was saying, you know, I think that for the most part, AI is going to really benefit the largest types of companies because they have the most data, they have the most scale, they have the ability to, you know, leverage their capital budget that's enormous, right? So they really should be the ones that benefit. And then we had DeepSeek, and suddenly it was possible to have a really great model for a fraction of the cost. And that really threw out this thesis that, you know, the early beneficiaries of AI were going to be the largest players that we all know. It is normal in these technology transitions to have these periods of infinite hype and infinite doom. I don't think AI is going to be any different. And I think it could actually be even more extreme in its movements. So, you know, all that said, I think we are seeing early signs of generative AI adoption in the workplace, particularly for technology companies. Many are using AI to write new software code, and they're replacing their lower-level programmers. And others are using analytics for customer service, data optimization. These are good beneficiaries, right? They're able to get better scale, better efficiency. The thing is that given the level of investment, which has been, I think we can all agree, substantial, the technology needs to do more than just create more efficiency, right? We need to create new business models. We need to create new revenue opportunities before you're going to see corporate America really jump on whole hog for that to establish. So, you know, I look forward to seeing how AI grows and evolves and develops. But in the meantime, we continue to avoid making investments that are solely based on a company's AI potential. Instead, we see it as a nice benefit if all goes well. Now, sometimes we get questions of how we're using AI internally. And what I would say is we're still in the early process of trying to figure out how this strategy makes us better at research, better at analysis. AI is really wonderful at being able to collapse a ton of disparate data and serve it up in a nice bite-sized form. And for some use cases, that makes sense. And for others, I think less so. Part of what I think distinguishes our research process is that it is so in-depth and that we spend so much time on the kind of boring source material of, you know, analyst reports, but most importantly, the company filings, which very few of my peers on Wall Street actually even read anymore. It's in the footnotes. You know, it's in the high-level discussions that we have with our CEOs and CFOs, where a lot of the qualitative analysis that distinguishes us really makes the most sense. It is actually in the places where we don't have a lot of data that we're able to have a differentiated point of view. And the thing that makes AI really tick is it needs tons and tons of data in order to be really good. So I think there will be places where we incorporate AI, but I actually don't think our research process will change dramatically. I think it's more about an ability to be more efficient, to be able to find the data that we're looking for more quickly. But a whole hog change in our research process, I don't see that on the near term.
Julie, the US dollar weakness and a shift to potentially more aggressive fiscal spending policies in Europe has given optimism to ex-US markets. Do you think this can continue?
So, as Americans, it's sometimes difficult for us to recognize how actions in the US affect markets abroad. While the US only accounts for about 5% of global population, we consume 30% plus of what is produced globally. 30% is a lot, but it doesn't actually dictate how markets abroad behave, and nor does it explain the recent strong outperformance of international markets relative to the US. So several factors are probably driving that divergence in equity market performance. First, valuations. At the beginning of the year, the US equity markets were near the top of their valuation ranges historically, with a PE ratio for the S&P 500 of roughly 30 at the end of 2024, compared to about 15.3 for the MSCI EAFE index. Since the start of the pandemic, we have seen money flowing continuously into U.S. markets, and that spigot reversed in the first quarter of 2025. It's challenging to estimate how much U.S. equities benefited from this international flow of capital, but if we look at the value of the U.S. stock market relative to the rest of the world, it's easy to see it is quite extreme compared to the percent of the world's GDP that the U.S. represents. Now, some of this flow of capital has been normalized over the last few months as investors have become a little worried about investing new money into U.S. equities. But I think there are other factors at play. The normal pattern of European austerity that we always hear about and American expansion has reversed. Europe recognizes it's been chronically underinvesting in its military and has stepped up plans to expand defense spending materially. And this is not just a rearming story. European banks, telecommunication stocks, insurance, those are all outperforming, with the least expensive stocks making the biggest moves higher. Meanwhile, the U.S. is trying to constrain government spending to get the deficit under control. Now, outside Europe and the U.S., we have seen the Chinese government stepping up to try to mitigate the impact of U.S. tariffs on its economy and to increase local consumption spending. If successful, this could benefit other Asian economies that trade with China, providing some relief from tariffs that will likely hurt their exports to the U.S. As with tariffs in the U.S., we think that attempting to predict global outcomes is a fool's errand. A far better strategy is to seek global diversification with quality companies. For example, just over 10% of small-cap companies in Europe have negative earnings, compared to roughly 40% in the U.S. Our international team continues to see quality companies abroad that are underpriced relative to their U.S. peers, using a bottom-up focus that is allowing these portfolios to add quality diversification in these turbulent times. Now, will this continue? It's really hard to say. I do think that, you know, we gain a certain amount of confidence in the reliability of this rally in Europe and international markets, just based on the fact that the valuations are still attractive. Even with this change and this contraction, you still can find good quality companies that are really attractively priced relative to their US analogs. But I think it's still uncertain exactly how all of these tariff changes are going to impact international production, how they trade with each other as they move away from us, and what the long-term consequences of that.
Julie, as always, thanks for taking the time to provide your insight to our Canecast listeners.
You've just listened to Canecast. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify. For more of our investing insights, head over to our website, www.cane.com. Canecast is the official podcast series of Kayne Anderson Rudnick Investment Management, CAR. This material is provided as a matter of general information and is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast or research. The opinions expressed herein are those of the speakers and are not necessarily the opinions of CAR or its affiliates, are current as of the date and time of the recording, and are subject to change at any time due to changes in market or economic conditions. The information and opinions contained in this material are derived from proprietary and non-proprietary sources deemed by CAR to be reliable and are not necessarily all-inclusive. CAR does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of this information. This communication should not be construed as an offer or solicitation to purchase or sell any security. Individuals should consult with a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions. Reliance upon information in this material is at the sole discretion of the listener. To the extent any performance is discussed, past performance is not indicative of future results.